The $500 Diet, Weight Loss for People Who Are Committed to Change by Ian Ayers. This audio presentation is read by the author.
Author's note. This booklet is a companion to the book Carrots and Sticks, Unlock the Power of Incentives to Get Things Done. In these pages, I tell you in a bit more detail about my own struggles with weight loss and lay out advice for how you can use commitment contracts to safely lose 10% of your body weight. You'll learn about my 7-step plan to a happier and lighter you. Most important, I tell you what you should do to keep it off. I check in and provide updates on the weight loss efforts of some people we first met in the book, and some other people we'll meet for the first time. Most diet books are written by physicians and scientists, but I'm a contract lawyer and an economist who uses the tools of my crafts to help you change how much you want to eat. Carrots and Sticks provided the background social science evidence for how to best tailor incentives. It shows how the behavioral revolution is helping people strengthen their resolve in a host of professional and personal settings. This booklet is a how-to guide that applies the wisdom of Carrots and Sticks to a personal health problem that has national and international ramifications. The $500 Diet. Chapter 1. The Hairless Harrier. In 1976, my high school newspaper published an unflattering photograph of me running shirtless with the caption, "Hairless Harrier." I was mortified. I was painfully thin, almost emaciated. For years, people had said I must be hiding a pirate's treasure somewhere because I had a sunken chest. One of my summer bosses asked me to keep a shirt on when I was working outside. When I graduated from college, I had a Lincoln-esque physique. Like our 16th president, I was about 6'4" and 180 pounds, but without any of his rail-splitting sinews. The good news was that I could eat prodigious amounts of food without getting fat. My sainted mother would regularly make me mastodonic breakfasts consisting of 8 pieces of bacon, 8 pieces of toast, 4 eggs, and 4 crepes stuffed with vanilla ice cream, then smothered with hot maple syrup. I was the master of the quick jam, a way to prepare and consume a huge number of warm, gooey calories in just a handful of seconds. I taught my friends how to make pop-em-up eggs in our family's first microwave oven. While 2 slices of bread were toasting, I would use the microwave to poach an egg in a small bowl of melted butter. I had just enough time to scarf down 1 molten cholesterol sandwich while the makings for the next one were being zapped by this electronic wonder of culinary science. In 1987, when I was 28 and took my first academic job at the American Bar Foundation in Chicago, my eating habits used to appall my abstemious boss, Bill Felstener. Bill was in his 50s and rightfully proud about his conscientious diet and low cholesterol numbers. I would make a point of sitting next to him and downing an entire pint of Häagen-Dazs rum raisin ice cream with my lunch. But just about the time I turned 30, everything changed. Quote, "I was completely broadsided by the fact that your body doesn't react the same way as you get older," unquote. This quotation is from baseball great Curt Schilling discussing his own midlife onset of weight loss problems, but it applied equally well to me. Suddenly, for the first time in my life, I could gain weight. I started growing what in Chicago is sometimes referred to as an alderman, a paunch of fat around the belly. This was particularly unattractive because I remained biaphrically thin in my chest. I remember getting on the scale at the home of my friend and co-author, Peter Siegelman, and finding out that I suddenly weighed more than 200 pounds. I just couldn't believe it. Almost immediately, I went on a crash diet. It wasn't that hard for me to skip meals and starve myself, some days combining just 1 meal with 2 extended workouts. I perversely became fascinated with pushing the envelope to see how little I could consume before my body would rebel at being deprived of sustenance. The pounds just melted off me. I lost about 5 pounds a week. In a little over a month, I was back to my fighting weight and a better self-image. As I look back now, my conduct seems borderline anorexic. It's not safe to try to lose more than 2 pounds a week. Moreover, it doesn't teach you anything. When I was fanatically dieting, I was probably eating enough to support a body weight of just 160 pounds. No wonder the pounds were flying off me. But it wasn't sustainable, and it didn't teach me what eating enough to support a 180-pound feels like. The vast majority of people who lose weight quickly end up regaining it. I was no exception. Within a couple of years, my weight again ballooned. No problem, I thought. I'd lost weight easily before. I'd just go on another crash diet. The problem was that this second time around, my body crashed. I deprived myself to the point of exhaustion, but didn't feel better even when I allowed myself to eat a second and third meal each day. Even after a good night's sleep, I'd wake up enervated. I was now teaching at the idyllic Stanford campus and falling in love with the woman whom I would soon marry, but I was having trouble pulling myself out of my diet-induced torpor. When I broke down and went to see a doctor, I learned that I had mononucleosis. It was a good half year until I was feeling myself again. I can't know for sure that starving myself caused the onset of my mono, but it sure didn't help. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't so enervated that I stopped teaching or writing. In the ensuing years, Jennifer and I had two sweet babies. I ended up happily teaching at Yale. Overall, these were the best of times. But my weight kept yo-yoing. I'd diet and lose weight, then I'd become inattentive. I'd stop getting on the scale for a couple of months. At some point, I'd realize that it had been a while since I checked my weight, and often there would be a few more weeks when I would avoid weighing myself because I'd be scared about what I would find. When I finally did get on the scale, I'd usually find that I gained back half of what I lost, and I'd throw in the towel, gaining weight until I would be so filled with disgust that I'd begin the cycle again, the only variation being that with each cycle, I would plateau at a higher weight. This story is at once deeply embarrassing to me and also painfully commonplace. The boring truth is that I'm just one of millions of people who start out to put on pounds in midlife and unsuccessfully struggle to take them off. Things didn't really change until the beginning of 2007. Once again, I was filled with self-disgust and massively out of shape. I had stopped exercising that previous fall, and my weight ballooned to 205 pounds. I plugged my height and weight into a body mass index, a BMI calculator, and was aghast to learn that this skinny kid from Kansas City, who couldn't put on a pound to save his life in high school, was now officially overweight, with a BMI greater than 25. I resolved once again to get back to 180 pounds, but this time I did something different. I backed up my weight loss resolution by putting $500 at risk each week for the entire year. To start off, I had to lose a pound a week until my weight dropped below 185 pounds, and then I had to keep my weight below 185 pounds for the rest of the year. I really wanted to weigh 180, but I figure I should give myself a safety cushion of 5 pounds to account for normal fluctuations. Here's what happened. In the first 10 weeks, my weight plummeted, dropping from 205 to 180 pounds. Now, this is something not to be proud of. Losing weight at a pace of 2.5 pounds a week was a bit slower than my craziest diets of the past, but still too aggressive. My good friend and author of The Perfect Fit Diet, Dr. Lisa Sanders, told me frankly, "You know you're going to put the weight back on." Dr. Sanders, who also runs an obesity clinic, knows of what she speaks. People who diet routinely lose weight for 3 to 4 months, but the safe money is always on them regaining it in the remainder of the year. For example, in a 2-year randomized study analyzing the impact of Weight Watchers, researchers found that people on Weight Watchers were able, on average, to lose 12 pounds after 6 months. But by the end of 2 years, almost half of the weight was regained. The point here isn't to beat up on Weight Watchers. Study after study of all kinds of diets shows exactly the same pattern. Initial success for 3 to 6 months, followed by a very substantial regain of the weight during the next year or two. The depressing truth is that only about 1 in 5 successful dieters are able to maintain a 10% weight loss through the end of the first year. It's hard work to join the 10% club, but it's even harder work to remain a member. So what is remarkable about my weight loss in 2007 isn't that I lost weight, it's how steady my weight remained for the rest of the year. After the first 10 weeks, my weight remained remarkably constant, staying within a 5-pound range between 178 and 183 pounds. It was during these remaining 40 weeks that I was teaching myself what it feels like to eat a 180-pound diet. Even if you keep the weight off through the end of the first year, you're still not out of the woods. It takes at least 2 years to reset your body clock to a new level of consumption. Maybe the most depressing news is that even after 2 years, about people in the 10% club still have about a 50% risk of regaining the weight. It's still not clear what side of the 50% I'll end up on. In my case, my weight remained remarkably flat for about 2 years. But toward the end of 2009, it started creeping up again. I had stopped putting money at risk, and I had stopped regularly getting on the scale. I'm pretty sure my weight never went above 200 pounds, but I might have flirted with 190. Even after many months of maintaining a 180-pound diet, I found it all too easy and enjoyable to start having seconds and thirds. The teenager who loved his ice cream-infused crepes and his pop-em-up egg still yearns to be set free. There are no guaranteed lifetime memberships for the 10% Club. This booklet shows you how you can increase your chance of sustaining a healthy weight for the rest of your life. If you're overweight, it sets out a plan that will give you a better shot of joining the 10% Club and remaining a member. It's a very different kind of diet plan because it doesn't tell you how much to eat or exercise. You're smart enough, with the help of the internet and dozens of dieting books, to figure that out. What's unique about the $500 diet is that it works on another dimension. It lets you change your own incentives to lose weight. When I finally confronted the fact that my success was slipping, I went back on the $500 diet, and with very little psychological or physical discomfort, I rejoined the 10% Club. This morning, October 14th, 2010, I weighed 179.2 pounds. You can check whether I currently have $500 at risk and my current weight by searching for my name at www.stickkk.com. Chapter 2, The Plan. Could you lose a pound in the next week to keep from losing $500? That simple question is at the heart of the $500 diet. If framed as a choice between losing a pound and losing a substantial amount of money, most people could make sure they lost the pound. It's not rocket science. If you eat a little bit less, possibly together with a bit more exercise, you're sure to lose a pound. If you burn 500 calories more than you eat each day, you will lose about a pound per week. If you're really serious about losing weight, putting something like $500 at risk changes your incentives to have the second helping of mashed potatoes. Is the pleasure you get from that extra food really worth losing a serious chunk of change? If you're unsure about whether $500 would be enough to deter you from overeating, what about $1,000? Surely there is some amount that is large enough to keep you on the straight and narrow. If you couldn't lose a pound to save $10,000, then this isn't the diet for you. It's a separate question, which I'll address in the next chapter, whether you can bring yourself to sign up for such a diet. But as a starting point, ask yourself whether the prospect of forfeiting money would change your behavior. For most people, the answer is a resounding yes. This means you hold the key to your success. Like Odysseus, you can tie your hands to the mast of sustained weight loss. I co-founded a company, www.stickkk.com, that lets you set a goal and back it up by risking money if you fail. At Stick, you can put $500 at risk if you don't lose a pound a week until you reach your goal. And then you can continue to put money at risk and to make sure you don't gain it back. The beauty of the Stick approach is that it can be free. Calling this approach the 500 diet will probably scare a lot of people away from even considering the method. Who wants to have to pay to lose weight? But in fact, the $500 diet uses the threat of losing a chunk of cash to strengthen your resolve. Weight Watchers cost about $500 a year, and as we saw, the average person at the end of 2 years lost about 6 or 7 pounds. I put $500 at risk each week, but in equilibrium, I've lost 25 pounds, about 12% of my body weight, and so far it hasn't cost me anything. Even if I hit the tripwire someday in the future and lose $500, I will have every incentive to get my caloric house back in order to avoid getting hit a second time. You see, I might have as easily called the diet the $26,000 diet, because this is the amount that I put at risk every year. So what specifically should you do to start? Well, here's a 7-step plan. Step number 1, set a specific and reasonable goal. Too many people skip over this part because they already know what weight they want to be. For me, it was how much I weighed when I graduated from college. For others, it's the weight at which they can wear their favorite skinny jeans. A 1997 study of obese dieters found that most people want to lose more than 30% of their initial weight. Most adults want to go back and experience the relative slenderness of their youth. They want to weigh within 5 pounds of what they weighed when they were 20, or if 20 was a bad year, they want to weigh the lowest adult weight they were able to sustain for a year. But just because your goal is to play in the NBA doesn't mean that you have a reasonable shot of achieving it. It's unreasonable to set a goal of losing more than 10% of your current weight. The sad consensus is that without gastric bypass surgery, it's just not possible for most people to sustain weight loss of more than 10%. The healthcare community has responded by trying to jawbone dieters into setting more realistic goals. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recommends that dieters try for just 5 to 10% reduction in weight. Healthcare researchers stress that there are demonstrable benefits in reducing hypertension, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia from these more modest percentages, even when patients remain considerably overweight. To bridge the gap between the unrealistic subjective goals of the overweight and the more realistic goals supported by empirical evidence, some weight loss counselors suggest a stepped approach. For example, Weight Watchers will not let you try to lose more than 10% of your initial weight as an initial goal. Only if you lose 10% of your body weight are you allowed to set a goal of shedding more pounds. The National Institute of Health also recommends an initial goal of no more than 10%, but adds, quote, "With success, further weight loss can be attempted if indicated through further assessment," unquote. But nowhere does it say when further weight loss would be indicated. This reminds me a bit of my childhood goal of learning to play the drums. My parents put me off by convincing me that I should learn to play the piano first. Then I could take on the drums. Come to think of it, I never did have a drum lesson. It would be more honest for the NIH to tell people that they shouldn't attempt further weight loss until they have successfully kept 10% of their body weight off for a year, and acknowledge that very few will make it to their first anniversary. If you've made bad choices in the past and find yourself weighing 20% more than you should, your most feasible option is to take off 10% and try to keep it off. As a statistical matter, a large proportion of the excess weight is irredeemably there to stay. Once your body has learned how pleasurable it is to eat that extra food, it's very difficult to retrain it to accept fewer calories. This is a bitter pill for dieters to accept, for the simple reason that most obese people want to lose a lot more than 10% of their body weight. But unfortunately, for people who have slipped into obesity with body mass indexes above 30, sustaining a weight loss of this magnitude is very rarely achievable. One way to figure out whether or not your goal weight is reasonable is to work backwards from the number of daily calories that you'd have to eat to maintain that mass. The simple starting point is the rule of 10. You can eat about 10 calories a day for every pound you want to maintain. Since I want to weigh 180 pounds, that means I wouldn't be able to eat more than 1,800 calories a day. The rule of 10 is just a rough rule of thumb. It works best for those among us who are sedentary. Since I have a pretty good record of sustaining a moderate level of activity, I might be able to eat 15 calories per day, or 2,700 calories. If the prospect of a 2,000-calorie daily diet and moderate exercise is beyond your reach, don't be thinking you'll be able to sustain 180 pounds for very long. In setting your goal weight, be clear about what you're trying to achieve. My spouse had a law school classmate who once asked if she was working out to, quote, "look better naked," unquote. I'd never thought about dieting in terms of how I look without clothes, but I have dieted to look better. Aesthetically, I'd like to look closer to how I looked when I was in my 20s. But I shouldn't fool myself into believing that my dieting has been deeply about health. There's pretty strong evidence that being obese with a BMI over 30 or underweight with a BMI under 18.5 is bad for you, in the most direct sense of increasing your chance of early death. But the evidence is, at best, equivocal on whether people who are merely overweight with BMIs between 25 and 30 are at risk. Some longitudinal studies even suggest that being slightly overweight increases your lifespan. When I found out I weighed in at 205 pounds, I was filled with a kind of self-loathing. But I shouldn't fool myself into thinking that a BMI of 25.3 was an unhealthy weight, even if it does fall into the overweight classification. Keep in mind, too, that your forfeiture weight and your goal weight are two different things. Your forfeiture weight should be higher than your goal weight. When you're choosing a forfeiture weight, you should also make sure to give yourself some wiggle room. I wanted to go from 205 to 180 pounds, but I set my forfeiture ending weight at 185 so that I could have a second piece of cake on my daughter's birthday without worrying. I wanted a warning track of 5 pounds to let me take corrective action before I hit the forfeiture wall. 5 pounds is about the amount that adult weight normally fluctuates, taking into account things like meals, menstruation, and exercise. You might even want to use this 5-pound trick at the beginning of your weight loss resolution. I started my diet weighing 205 pounds, but might have started the forfeiture weight at 210 and have it decline by a pound a week from this inflated amount. That way, I'd have a few weeks to get my dieting act together, knowing that the forfeiture pendulum would swing ever lower. Step number 2. Don't try to lose too quickly. Setting reasonable goals also means thinking about the rate at which you're going to try to lose weight. It just isn't safe to try to lose more than 2 pounds a week. It puts unreasonable strain on your body. I should know, extreme dieting very likely contributed to my suffering from mono. A goal of 1 pound per week has an even better chance of sustained success. Of course, if you stand to lose a chunk of cash in weighing too much, you might be tempted to lose a lot of weight just to stay ahead of that forfeiture tripwire. Inflating your starting forfeiture weight just a bit will give you time to start in more gradually without risking loss. You might also think about making a second commitment to counteract the starvation impulse. You can put another chunk of cash at risk if you lose more than 5 pounds in any given week. At the very least, do not be proud of quick weight loss. Frankly, I'm worried that many people who are most attracted to commitment contracts are the kind of people who want a quick fix. Many of you heedlessly jump past these first two guidelines. Dieters are victims of their own goal setting, not just in trying to lose too much weight, but also in trying to lose it too quickly. We fail to pick reasonable initial goals. We say that we would be unsatisfied with even losing 15% of our body weight, and hence are doomed to failure. It's a recipe for disaster. Step number 3, put the right amount at risk. Here you should follow the advice of Goldilocks, or the Delphic Oracle, and seek the middle path. In all things, moderation. You should put an amount at risk each week that is not too big and not too small. Don't expect to lose much weight if you don't put enough at risk to catch your attention. I was slightly miffed when Haley Cohen published an article about her own unsuccessful attempt to use stick.com to stop her from saying like inappropriately. She concluded, quote, "There's no way that an extrinsic service or motivator is going to be able to force you to do something. You have to have some sort of internal, intrinsic motivation to do it," unquote. Yet, she put only $9.99 at risk because, quote, $10 just seemed too scary to send the George Bush Library, unquote. Now, that's not much extrinsic motivation. It's almost as if Haley planned to fail and write the article. She might be right about needing intrinsic motivation, but it would have been a fairer test of the proposition if she'd put something more meaningful at risk, like maybe like $500. Then again, you shouldn't make Antonio's mistake from The Merchant of Venice and put your very life on the line. We limit our users' stakes at stick.com, the amount they put at risk on a contract, to less than $10,000. And our terms and conditions require users to represent that the total of all commitment stakes authorized by client is less than 10% of client's annual income, unquote. You shouldn't put at risk an amount that you can't afford to lose, but it might be an amount that is sufficient to cause some financial sacrifice and definitely should be large enough and unusual enough to be meaningful. For me, $500 a week feels right and so far has been effective. But the amount might change over time as either my finances or my psyche changes. 20 years ago, Lisa Sanders used a commitment contract to quit smoking. She started by putting $1,000 at risk if she ever smoked another cigarette, but increased her stakes to $5,000 as her wealth increased. It's not a legitimate objection to say, I just don't have $500 that I can put at risk. If you don't have a penny, a halfpenny will do. Think about the amount of money you spend each week on some things you enjoy, lattes at Starbucks, Saturday night movies, etc., and put those privileges at risk. Everyone has the ability to put 10 or 20% of their discretionary income at stake. Step number 4, decide who gets your money if you fail. When setting up your commitment, you should also think about what will happen to your money if you don't succeed. In my book, Carrots and Stick, I write about a student who promised to give $100 to charity for every month she failed to turn in a paper revision. Even though $100 a month seems like a substantial amount at the time she made the promise, she ended up paying off on this promise for 10 years before I let her out of it. After the fact, it's all too easy to start thinking of forfeitures as the mere price of procrastination, and not all that big a price, especially if you were going to give some money to charity that year anyway. Why not forfeit on your commitment contract and cut back on your other contributions? Cognitively, you can convince yourself that you already gave at the office. An important way to take arms against this kind of after-the-fact rationalization is to raise the size of your stakes. I like the MS Society, but I don't want to give them $20,000 a year. Alternatively, you can set up a stick contract that forfeits if you fail to a charity you don't like. We call them anti-charities, and they are particularly popular at stick.com. You can choose upfront to have any forfeited money go to the George W. Bush Presidential Library or the William Jefferson Clinton Presidential Library if you're not a fan of his predecessor. Or you might choose a frenemy. It's hard to tell yourself after the fact that you really wanted money going to that ex-boyfriend or ex-girlfriend who treated you so badly. If you're willing to try something a bit more cutting edge, you might even sell your forfeiture rights. In September 2010, I posted the following auction item on eBay. Buy Ian Ayres' right to gain weight and earn between $0 and $26,000. The winner of this auction will earn the right to receive any forfeitures on Ian Ayres' weight maintenance contract at stick.com for the next 52 weeks. I will be putting at risk $500 a week for the next 52 weeks. Following the auction's close, and as soon as I receive payment from the auction winner, I will designate the winner as the recipient of any forfeiture payments made on my stick.com maintenance contract for the next 52 weeks. Any week during this 52-week period where 1. I fail to report to Stick my progress on the contract, 2. I report that my weight is above $185, or 3. My referee, Barry Nailbuff, Yale game theorist and Ayres co-author, reports that my weight is above 185 pounds. The auction winner will receive 500 pounds. If I fail in each and every week, the auction winner could receive as much as $26,000. But beware. My weight on August 4th, 2010 is about 180 pounds. I intend to make sure that my weight stays below 185 pounds throughout the 52 weeks. So it is possible, even probable, that the auction winner will not receive any forfeiture money. It would be foolhardy to bid very much on this item. .23 bidders put in a total of 45 bids on this auction item, and the winning bid was a lot more than I expected, $282.85. Of course, that isn't much compared to the $26,000 I put at risk. Then again, I had been putting a lot of money at risk with anti-charity stick contracts for years without getting any compensation. So earning almost $300 for doing what I was going to do anyway felt kind of nice. And the bidders were smart to heed my warning and not bid very much. The winning bid implicitly suggests that my probability of failure is about 1% a week. Like Subway's spokesman Jared, I have all kinds of incentives to keep my weight in check. But this fairly simple auction shows that it's possible to get paid hundreds of dollars by non-altruistic strangers for committing to do what's good for you. The idea for this auction comes from James Herman, a New Zealand advertising executive who in 2008 successfully sold his smoking addiction. You can learn a lot more about him and his auction in, you guessed it, my book, Carrots and Sticks. Step number 5, choose a referee and tell several supporters. While Stick.com uniquely offers users the ability to put money at risk on their commitments, it is a service that also offers users the freedom to deploy a variety of different forms of accountability. If you just want reminders, we'll nag you. If you think you'll do better letting someone else decide whether you succeed or fail, you can choose a refereed contract. A referee is a good way to commit to being honest in the future. When money's at stake, it's all too easy for some people to, well, lie to the site to avoid losing money. But when you're choosing a referee, don't pick someone who's too close to you. Someone who's too sympathetic to your plight may be more likely to let you slide if you fail to achieve your goal. Somebody who works at your gym is probably a better referee than your spouse if you're committed to exercising 3 times a week. When I started writing Carrots and Sticks, I thought that having a referee was the key ingredient to back up a financial commitment. But in speaking with dozens of stick users, I've come to believe that having multiple supporters is even more important. Supporters are automatically told whether you have reported success or failure. If you commit to stop biting your fingernails and put $100 at risk each week, it will be pretty hard to cheat if a dozen coworkers and friends are getting weekly reports that you have reported success. You can even turn the world into supporters by committing to publicly post your success or failure. Drew Magary's public humiliation diet used the power of Twitter reports to take off 60 pounds in just 5 months. The key idea is to combine layers of accountability. You don't want to just rely on any one thing. The power of the Stick platform is that it lets you combine different forms of accountability, be it nagging and bragging or crowing and owing, to keep you on the straight and narrow. I've had particular success in combining financial commitments with the notion of arm's length support. At the beginning of 2007, I put an ad in the Yale Student Employment Office saying I wanted to hire someone who was willing to nag me if I failed to meet specific goals. The nagger's job was simple. Once a day, the nagger logged into a Google spreadsheet document that I created and checked to see if I was keeping any one of 5 different commitments. I had made resolutions to read 30 pages of novels, to write 800 words, and exercise 20 minutes every day. I also committed to losing weight, and I committed to lifting weights every other day. The nagger's job wasn't to make sure that I was in perfect compliance every day, but if she saw that I was failing for 2 or 3 days in a row, including failure to make entries to the spreadsheet, she was supposed to intervene. If I started to slip, her instructions were first to email me. If the problem persisted, she was instructed to call and even come by my house to, well, nag me into compliance. A byproduct of this nagging regime is that I was forced for the first time to keep a daily calendar of a few problematic areas of my life. Nagging has worked for me like gangbusters. I committed to exercise more, and I swam over 100 miles the first year. Even more amazingly, for the first time in my life, I can do 10 unassisted pull-ups. High school classmates who remember me as the hairless harrier will not believe this is possible. I committed to read more and have had the pleasure of reading more than 40 novels. And most important, I committed to writing more and was able to submit my last book, Super Crunchers, on time. Or to be more accurate, the threat of nagging has worked for me. You see, the nagger only had to email me about a half dozen times during the year, and the intervention never needed to proceed to a telephone call or the dreaded home visit. I would have found it deeply embarrassing to have a student call me on the carpet, and was well motivated to make sure it didn't happen. One of the coolest things about commitment contracts is that they can be effective and cheap. The cost of nagging wasn't free, but paying someone to log on once a day and send a total of 5 emails over the course of the year was incredibly inexpensive. This past year, I've experimented with an even cheaper version, where the nagger, at least initially, only has to check my online diary once a week. But it's just too easy for me to forget to post on a regular basis, and too easy for the single nagger to stop doing her job. So it's probably time for me to add more supporters. Step number 6. Now take action to achieve your goal. As promised above, I have the least to say about this crucial central step. Low-calorie, low-fat, and low-carb diets all have shown similar short-term results. If you want the one that's most likely to work for you, I recommend taking Lisa Sanders' Perfect Fit Diet Questionnaire. The big idea is that the $500 diet isn't a substitute for traditional approaches, it's a complement. Once you put $500 at risk, you're smart enough to sign up for Weight Watchers, or Jenny Craig, or Nutrisystems, or Atkins. You might even decide it's worthwhile to read my companion book, Carrots and Stick, where you'll learn the behavioral science backing up this plan, including a discussion of the cutting-edge Stop Regain follow-up program. You'll figure out that you should avoid filling your plate for seconds and thirds. But knowledge isn't really the problem. You already know you're more likely to lose weight if you move around a bit and control your portion size. In fact, eating less and or exercising more isn't just a good idea, it's the law when it comes to dieting. The second law of thermodynamics foreordains an inevitable metabolic inefficiency in all biological processes, including us. As a theoretical matter, you could try to lose weight by increasing the metabolic inefficiency of the biological machine that you are. You're fooling yourself, though, if you think you're going to lose weight by supercharging your metabolism. As an empirical matter, there's no good evidence that sustained weight loss can be achieved by holding your caloric intake the same, but simply turning yourself into an engine that burns energy without doing any work. You're better off, from a weight loss perspective, treating a calorie as a calorie. To lose weight, you can either eat less energy or burn more of it by increasing your physical activity. And cutting your calorie input is usually more important than increasing your physical activity. The angels in heaven cry when they hear dieters say things like, quote, muscle weighs more than fat, and that's why working out is making me heavier, unquote. I'm tempted to tell you about all my personal strategies for eating less. I found it helpful to limit my solo eating. I try to limit myself to 3 full plates of food a day and only eat fruits between meals. I immediately kindled to Drew McGarry's advice, he of the humiliation diet, to drink a cup of hot green tea at the end of meals. Quote, it's an appetite suppressant, he says. Plus, it makes me feel like I just ate a very large Chinese meal, which is fun. I needed something to demarcate the end of a meal, because otherwise I just keep eating until all my meals blended together. His reasoning made sense, and I've added it to my bag of tricks. But my bigger advice is to go out and figure out what works for you. Discovering your secrets to eating less will give you more of a feeling of ownership of your own personal weight loss. It's all too easy to get lost on the details of implementation and lose sight. The big problem is figuring out a way to stiffen your resolve. The $500 diet tackles that problem head on and leaves the details to you. With a bunch of money at stake, you'll have every incentive to do the right thing. Step number 7. Commit to maintenance. Let me end by returning to the topic of goal setting. By far the biggest mistake that nearly everyone makes in dieting is failing to commit to a long-term strategy. In Carrots and Sticks, I tell the success story of Andy Mayer, an executive at a Fortune 100 healthcare company who used a commitment contract to lose 20 pounds. And he did everything right. He put $1,500 at risk, set a reasonable weight loss goal, and set off to lose a pound per week for 20 weeks. And he used layers of accountability. In fact, it was Andy who started to teach me about the importance of having multiple supporters. He told me how hard it was for him to email his friends and family telling them about his weight loss commitment, because Andy knew once he told them, he'd have to follow through. Sure enough, 20 weeks later in 2009, Andy was 20 pounds lighter. Like me, he dropped from about 200 pounds to 180. The problem for successful dieters is almost always maintenance. It's hard to become a member of the 10% Club, but it's 10 times harder to maintain your membership. I originally talked to Andy when he was flushed with pride soon after achieving his 20-pound weight loss goal with Stick.com. But he was taken aback when I pressed him to sign up then and there for a maintenance contract. I wanted him to commit not to let his weight rise more than 5 or 10 pounds above his new low. Andy resisted my prodding. He was physically and psychologically exhausted from his recent dieting efforts and felt like he needed to take a commitment break. I understand. In the last year, I too experimented with having a kind of break from my more formal weight commitments. My personal nagger became a bit more lax too, and sure enough, my girth started drifting up. Without a maintenance commitment, I knew it was unlikely Andy would be able to keep the weight off. In the book, I even made the following forecast. Quote, I'm rooting for Andy Mayer, but without a firmer maintenance plan, I predict that by the time this book is published, he will, like so many other, quote, successful dieters, have gained back at least half of his weight. This is one prediction I hoped wouldn't come true, but when I checked in with him just before the book's release, he was close to having gained back about three-quarters of his earlier hard-won success. Just after the book was published, Andy wrote in his blog, Life with Spidey, quote, unfortunately, the good professor is correct on pages 105 and 106 of his book that I should have entered into the maintenance contract. The 20th pound came off in May 2009. Now, in October 2010, I have indeed gained back half the weight, exactly what Ian predicted. Andy remains positive and continues to fight the good fight. He's still a fan of Stick.com and using the threat of a loss to change personal behavior, but publicly committing for him remains the key. He recently wrote, quote, telling the world your weight loss goal and goal date and then posting your current weight on a daily basis is even more motivating. Much like me, Andy is attracted to the power of the humiliation diet. We're also both fans of Brian Stelter, who tweets every calorie he consumes. When I last checked, Brian had more than 1,400 Twitter followers who tune in to see the prosaic but important business of weight loss. Quote, Thursday, 2 whole wheat waffles, syrup, 210, applesauce, 40, F1 bar, 140. Animal crackers, 100. Plantain chips, 105. Coffee with milk, 50. I'm concerned, however, about the speed of Brian's weight loss. He reported in the New York Times that he lost 75 pounds in 25 weeks, dropping from 275 to 200. That's just too much weight in too little time. I'm even more worried that Brian, like Andy and me, will have trouble keeping the weight off. I'm worried he hasn't adequately committed to maintain his svelte, newfound self. Dieting without a maintenance plan is like invading a country without any idea what you'll do once you succeed. People spend too much time thinking about the first 20 or 25 weeks and not enough time thinking about the next 2 years. You should plan ahead for success by committing in advance to make a long-term commitment to maintain any weight that is initially lost. It's easier to make a conditional commitment to commit before you start the process. If you're about to try to lose 30 pounds, promise that if you succeed, you'll create a commitment contract backed by some non-trivial amount, see point 3, to maintain at least 25 pounds for the following year. Or if that seems too extreme, commit to a maintenance plan where you will forfeit money if you don't keep off at least half of what you worked so hard to lose in the first place. If you aren't willing to make this commitment to commit, why go to the trouble of taking off the pounds in the first place? Being svelte for 3 or 4 months isn't going to bring you much health or happiness. Most people proud of having just reduced 1 or 2 sizes swear to themselves that they will never again let their weight swell, but few of us take action to avoid the almost inevitable re-inflation. Committing to a maintenance plan is the single most important piece of advice in this booklet. If you've just hit your goal weight, I beg you, number one, make a stick.com year-long contract backed by a pot of money not to regain more than a third of what you've lost. And number two, make a second stick.com contract, again with backed by another pot of money at risk, not to regain more than half of what you've lost. If you're about to embark on a serious diet, commit in advance to maintain your goal weight for at least a year. Setting the right goals at the beginning and end of the diet plays a crucial role in your chances of lasting success. The news media could do us dieters a big favor if it spent less time focusing on short-term diet success. It just isn't that unusual for people in the course of 3 to 6 months to lose 20, 30, even 75 pounds. It's like the old joke about smoking. It's easy to quit smoking. I've done it several times. What happens in the first 6 months of a diet isn't nearly as important as what happens in the second 6 months. So there you have it, a 7-step diet that can change your life. With the help of stick.com, committing to real change can start with just a few clicks of your mouse. Chapter 3, I Just Couldn't. The best plan in the world is worthless if no one is willing to sign up. Many, many dieters will not be able to bring themselves to put any substantial money at risk to back up a commitment to lose weight. It can be downright dangerous to bet that you're going to be thinner if you're a compulsive eater. A well-known author and former member of Overeaters Anonymous confided in me that she was scared to enter into a commitment contract at stick.com because she was afraid she would lose too much money if she couldn't lose the weight. But there is much less risk with a promise to report your weight or to regularly attend Weight Watchers meetings. You may not be able to control outcomes. You may not even be able to control momentary lapses in resolve. But there's no reason on earth why you can't commit to get on the scale once a week. In the last chapter, I told you about Brian Stelter, one of the growing number of people who tweets everything he eats. This can be a great short-term strategy. But for most, it's not sustainable. Very, very few people can bring themselves to fill out daily food journals. I tell my first-year law students that it's better to take 30 words of notes for a case than 300 words, because they're more likely to sustain their shorter note-taking throughout their law school career. It's hard to fill out a food journal day after day. Better to commit to getting on the scale. Indeed, you might even splurge and buy a wonderful new piece of technology, the Withings Wi-Fi scale. This device is a bit pricey. It retails for $159, though it's cheaper on Amazon, but works like a dream. I bought one recently, and within 25 minutes of opening the box, I had the scale connected to the internet and publishing my weight, BMI, and body fat percentages based somewhat crudely on bioelectrical impedance data, to Withings.com, to the Withings iPhone app, and to a special Twitter account that I created just for this purpose. Easy peasy. Somehow, it magically distinguishes among the 4 members of my family and tracks our info separately. Each member can separately choose whether and with whom to share the data. Consider this an unsolicited rave review. This automated reporting provides 2 connected values for dieters. First, the Wi-Fi scale makes it easier for you to keep track of your weight. It seems like it shouldn't be that much of a hassle to write down your weight after getting on the scale. For more than a year, I did just that on Google Docs. But every extra click reduces the chance that you'll sustain the behavior. The automation of the recording process means that a lot of people are going to remain a lot more mindful of where they are and where they've been. Second, the automated reporting makes it harder to fudge when you're telling your weight loss to others. Even though my Twitter account, twitter.com/IanWeight, currently has fewer than 50 followers, the information is there for anyone to see. Indeed, if you're connected to the internet, you can pause right now and click over and find out how I'm doing. I've contacted the good people at Withings, and hopefully you will soon have the option to link your Withings data to your Stick account. Simply standing on the scale may soon satisfy your Stick reporting requirement. Less hassle means more sustained compliance. My biggest surprise in using a Wi-Fi scale, however, has been in experiencing a new range of emotions, including excitement and a kind of fear when I'm about to stand on the scale. I'm committed to report my weight honestly to Stick.com and stand ready to step up whenever my referee calls me to his scale. But notwithstanding my commitment to honesty, it's a little scary to give up control over how I report my weight. What if the scale goes haywire and mistakenly reports to Twitter that I weigh more than 185 pounds? What if that burrito I ate last night puts me above the forfeiture weight? This fear of unintermediated reporting will be too much for many reasonable people. Many will not want to post their weight to a public Twitter account. But committing to simply get on the scale at least once a week and privately keep track of your weight can by itself be a powerful long-term tool. The kind of mindfulness commitment becomes all the more sustainable if the scale does all the subsequent paperwork for you. If you prefer committing to a particular weight, but you're scared you won't be able to achieve and sustain your true goal weight, then think about adding 10 pounds to the goal and committing to weighing less than that. Layering a series of contracts with staggered forfeiture weights can also be less risky than all-or-nothing commitments. Instead of my $500 contract to stay below 185, you might forfeit $100 if your weight goes above 185, $200 if your weight goes above 195, and $300 if your weight tops 205. Since satisfying the dreaded participation constraint is so important with regard to maintenance plans, my friend who's scared about putting money at risk on a weight maintenance bet might do better to reward herself by buying something special if she can maintain her new weight, while simultaneously putting money at risk if she fails to step on the scale for some unreasonably protracted period. So I don't have to use that expletive Stick.com. Of course, there are other emotions besides fear that keep people from really committing to change. Last fall, I saw my referee and recidivist co-author Barry Nailbuff and was struck by how much weight he'd lost. He had a clearly different body shape. I told him he looked great. Barry turned to my spouse and co-author, Jennifer Brown, and said, "I'm doing it on my own, so I don't have to use that expletive Stick.com." I was shocked. Not so much at the language. I've heard Barry drop the F-bomb a time or two. But it was so bizarre to have Barry shy away from using a commitment contract. Barry is a world-class game theorist who hasn't only written about the benefits of commitment devices, he's also used them to lose weight. He's the father of the bathing suit diet. Back in 1993, on the first day of a business school class course on game theory, Barry promised to teach his last class of the semester in a Speedo if he hadn't lost 15 pounds by then. You can learn a lot more about this story in the book, including how the diet temporarily got Barry in trouble with his boss. But the bottom line is that the bathing suit diet worked. His business students never got to see what I just saw this past summer at the swimming pool, the sight of Barry in the swimsuit. 13 years later, ABC Primetime televised Barry using the same embarrassment to help five perfectly sane but overweight people lose 15 unwanted pounds. ABC promised to show photographs of the Flab Five in skimpy swimsuits on national TV if they didn't lose the weight. Like me, Barry wasn't interested in giving them dieting or exercising tips. He just wanted the threat of exposure to motivate them to eat less. Quote, "We didn't do anything else," Barry told me. We didn't give them trainers. We didn't give them fitness coaches, nutrition coaches. But we did email them electronic versions of the photographs so that they could see what they looked like. Once again, the swimsuit sticks did the trick. Four of the five participants lost more than the requisite 15 pounds, and even the failure lost a commendable 13. So it came as a sobering surprise to hear Barry express such unbridled emotion when he said he was dieting on his own to avoid using, quote, that expletive stick.com. What was he thinking? Of course, Barry's comment has something to do with the fact that I'm one of the co-founders of Stick. But until writing this book, I've done very little proselytizing about the benefits of the $500 diet. I've never told overweight friends that I have the key to changing their lives. I never harangued Barry in the past to sign up for a Stick weight loss contract. But still, to be my friend is to know that a Stick contract is an option. A few days later, Barry was nice enough to sit down and discuss what was going on in that brief but striking exchange. Barry explained he'd feel less of a sense of personal achievement if he lost the weight because he had entered into a Stick commitment. Quote, think about when you were a teenager, Barry said. You have to write a term paper, and the question is, can you get the paper done without having to be nagged by your parents? On one level, the answer is that you only care about the paper being done. But on another level, you should ask yourself, what does it say about me as a person in terms of my maturity, my self-control, if I need to be nagged to finish it? I'd like to think that if this is a goal that's important to me, I can accomplish it straight out, unquote. In Barry's case, losing the weight has extra meaning. It's a birthday present for his wife. He has promised to lose 50 pounds for her 50th birthday. Instead of wearing a Speedo in public if he fails, for all I know, his plan this time may be to have fun disrobing in private if he succeeds. Barry and Helen might both feel that the gift is more meaningful if he does it on his own. Each time he resists a caloric temptation is an occasion for Barry to think about how much he loves Helen. That's a lot more romantic than dieting to avoid losing $500 a week. I get that. When I ask him if he thought there were any larger lessons from this story for other people, he responded with the story of a professor who was co-teaching a class with Barry and couldn't get his papers graded on time. And I said, this is Barry, quote, well, damn it, use Stick, Barry told me. And he said, no, I really will do the grading this weekend. But he didn't. And so I said, well, use Stick. And he said, no, I promise you by Wednesday. And again, he didn't get it done. So I finally said, okay, I don't trust you anymore, use Stick. And he did, and the papers got graded before he lost money, unquote. To my ear, this sounded like a great advertisement for the value of Stick contracts. But Barry quickly added, quote, however, I think both he and I would be happier if he could have managed to get it done without having to use Stick, unquote. This is where Barry and I see things differently. Barry thinks an inability to get your grading done shows a more generalized weakness of will. For Barry, it's okay to use an alarm clock as a kind of commitment device to get you up in the morning. But there's something a bit wrong with you if you need to put money at risk to make sure you get your grades done on time. I disagree. At Stick.com, lots of people use forfeiture contracts to make sure they get to work on time. And I don't think they or anyone else should think less of them for it. We should resist the urge to think that all accomplishments achieved through extrinsic motivation are somehow less worthy than those achieved solely with intrinsic desire. At the end of the day, it shouldn't matter what mixture of intrinsic and extrinsic prodding has led me to be able to do 10 pull-ups. More precisely, we shouldn't worry about needing some help to do things that aren't central to our core sense of self. It's one thing for Barry to want to succeed in a weight loss birthday present for his wife without the help of a Stick contract. It might cheapen the gift if Helen learned that it was accomplished merely because the sword of Damocles was dangling over his head. Unaided weight loss in this context feels more genuine, more authentic. But we should resist the puritanical notion that we need to do everything on our own in every dimension of our lives We should resist the universalizing preference for intrinsic over extrinsic motivation. I'd feel worse about myself if I needed a commitment contract to remember to tell my kids I love them. But I don't feel at all bad about using a stick contract to update my will. Indeed, using extrinsic motivation on this less important task might mean that I have a greater capacity to marshal my intrinsic motivation to attend to the things that I really care about. Partly, Barry and I simply disagree about whether grading exams on time should be the kind of thing intrinsically important enough to do without putting money at risk. Barry and I both think that professors should care enough about teaching that they shouldn't need to put money at risk to try to teach well. But I put the act of timely grading in another category. Grading law school exams is like having to watch a bad movie 50 times in a row. Few students write well under the pressure of a 3-hour time limit. Grading, like doing my taxes in a timely fashion, isn't part of my core identity. I wouldn't be embarrassed to need a little extrinsic help to make sure that these less important but still necessary things get done. It's because other things are more important in our lives that we should be open to using commitments to help on everything else. My primary obligations are to love my family, teach my classes, and publish scholarship. It's because I'm focused on these things that there should be no sense of lesser accomplishment that I read dozens of novels last year with the help of a commitment device. It's not a sign of weakness that I'm using the $500 diet to maintain a healthy weight. It's as a sign that I have my priorities straight. But I have an even more fundamental disagreement with the way we discount extrinsically motivated accomplishment. For me, the act of creating a commitment contract is every bit as much an act of intrinsic motivation as the act of resisting temptation after the fact. When it comes to commitment contracts, the dichotomy between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation is simply false. The parable of Jane and Joe. Jane and Joe both want to lose 10% of their current weight and are considering whether to use stick.com. Joe can't bring himself to sign the contract. It's just too scary to him. Jane is scared too. Indeed, imagine she's equally scared, but she really, really wants to lose weight and clicks, I agree, on a contract that puts $500 at risk every week. Creating the contract is a result of her intrinsic motivation. No one puts a gun to Jane's head and said she had to sign on the dotted line. Jane created the contract because she was intrinsically motivated to lose weight. Joe chooses to forego the stick contract and instead to subject himself to dozens of temptations that we all face in this brave new world of one-handed eating. If both Joe and Jane succeed, we tend to say Joe was intrinsically motivated while Jane was extrinsically motivated. But really, Jane had the intrinsic motivation to complete one high-stakes action, while Joe had the intrinsic motivation to complete a series of low-stake actions, resisting the daily temptation to eat. We might as easily say that Joe displayed a lack of intrinsic motivation because he wasn't able to bring himself to enter into a commitment contract. I wouldn't go that far, but it's a false dichotomy to think that the difference between Joe and Jane is the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. To be sure, the commitment contract once in place adds an extrinsic motive for losing weight, but the act of signing up takes great intrinsic motivation, more than many people can muster. Joe's act of intrinsic motivation is not more heroic because it comes later in time or because it must be sustained over a longer sequence of small temptations. We should at least equally valorize people like Odysseus, who have the internal fortitude to tie their hands to the mast. In fact, there's an important social context where we already have reframed the issue to make the single large commitment a sign of pride instead of shame. Consider marriage. The Joes of the world, with their cramped conception of intrinsic motivation, should resist the institution of marriage. They should stay faithful to their loved ones, resisting over time the repeated temptations to stray, because they are intrinsically motivated to do so. They shouldn't turn down the offer of an affair because they made a public commitment in front of their friends and family to stay true. To the Joes of the world, it should be an embarrassment to achieve fidelity because of an extrinsic consequence. How unromantic. But luckily, society does not take this view. The marriage ceremony is one in which couples take great pride in publicly undertaking a great act of commitment. We view their willingness to take the plunge as an act of courage, not cowardice. We view public recitation of vows as the epitome of romance. Jennifer lovingly teases me about how badly my shoulders twitched during our wedding ceremony as I unsuccessfully tried to stifle tears of joy. You might even want to take a page from the marriage playbook and create your own commitment ceremony celebration with family and friends. Having a religious figure formally bless your weight loss commitment is probably going a bit far. Then again, gluttony is one of the seven deadly sins. If at first you don't succeed, use stick. There's another lesson to be learned from Barry's cursing. Remember, Barry said, quote, "I'm doing it on my own, so I don't have to use that expletive stick.com," unquote. Until now, I've been focusing on the emotions behind that expletive. But there is also a causal claim underlying Barry's sentiment. Implicitly, Barry's statement suggests that if he fails, he's going to have to resort to using stick. If he can't do it on his own, he figures that as a game theorist and deviser of the bathing suit diet, he's going to have to take bolder action. I never realized it before, but the mere existence of stick is providing service to some people who know of it but never use it. Part of Barry's motivation to lose weight on his own is to avoid having to use stick. I must admit that this indirect commitment effect wasn't foremost in our minds when my co-founders and I set off to create a commitment store, but we're happy to be of service. So far, so good. With 10 weeks to go until Helen's birthday, Barry has already lost an Oprah-esque 35 pounds. I bet that he makes it. By now, you should also understand, by making his promise more public, I've made it even more likely that Barry will succeed. Barry made this backstop benefit of stick explicit when I asked him about the takeaways from his repeatedly nagging his tardy co-teacher. Specifically, I asked Barry if the implicit moral of the grading story is that if you failed 3 times at something, you should then be willing to use stick. Barry, with typical acuity, said, quote, "No, here's the line. If at first you don't succeed, then use stick," unquote. It's fine by me if weight loss is the kind of thing that you want to try without the aid of a commitment contract. I don't even mind if you reject the idea that creating a commitment contract is an act of intrinsic motivation. But for God's sake, if you've tried the intrinsic approach and have failed, accept a helping hand from stick. Life is too short, literally too short if you're obese. If, quote, "insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results," unquote, then it's crazy for people to repeatedly rely on future resolve that never seems to materialize. Indeed, you don't need to wait for failure. Put Barry's "if at first you don't succeed" nostrum into practice. Before you even make your very first attempt at weight loss, you can commit to using stick if you fail. You can commit to commit. To be specific, you can create a custom designed contract that simply says, "I commit to going on the $500 diet for a year if my weight loss is not less than X pounds 1 year from now." Making the conditional commitment will help strengthen your resolve so that you won't have to ever sign up for the $500 diet. And even if you fail, you will at least have broken the cycle of insanity. For things that are as tough as sustained weight loss, you don't need to wait to fail. You are permitted to look at the dismally low success rate of your fellow dieters who rely solely on intrinsic motivation. Sure, try to go it alone, but commit to stick as a backup plan. Conclusion: changing the conversation. The mere existence of stick.com changed the way Barry thought about weight loss. The option of using stick for him was by itself a goad, but the ready option of making credible commitments can also change the way we speak to one another about weight loss. About a month ago, I was speaking with a close family friend, whom I'll call Nora, who was trying to quit smoking. Nora has been a smoker for more than 20 years and had unsuccessfully tried to quit several times in the past. When we talked, she had just made it 3 weeks smoke-free. I, of course, praised her success. Then, just as I did with Andy Mayer, I urged her to increase her chance of success by using a commitment contract. Barry knew all too well about the game-theoretic power of commitments, but because Nora was less acquainted with the idea, I kicked into what now seems a bit too much of a hard sell. I told her about the powerful randomized controlled trial that Dean Carlin had run, showing that putting money at risk can lead to a fourfold increase in the odds of quitting smoking for up to a year. You can read more about Dean, the real brains behind stick.com, and his experiment in the book Carrots and Sticks. I asked her to envision how she would respond to commitment. I said, quote, "If smoking this next week would make you forfeit $500, wouldn't you stay smoke-free?" Unquote. She agreed, but worried about what would happen after the commitment was over. I told her that it didn't have to end. One of Nora's own friends, Lisa Sanders, has been successfully using a $5,000 commitment contract to stay off cigarettes for the last 20 years. Nora told me she really wanted to quit, but that she just wasn't comfortable putting money at risk, even though she admitted that it would increase her chance of success. I then uttered the words, quote, "You just left the door open," unquote. I wish I hadn't. It was a very awkward moment. I apologized for my remark the very next day. Here, Nora was justly proud of quitting for 3 weeks, and I intimated that she was leaving open the possibility of failure, especially after Nora had made it clear that she wasn't interested in commitment contracts. It wasn't appropriate for me to go the extra step and suggesting that she was therefore bound to fail. That's not persuasion. That's just a guilt trip. But as, or perhaps I should say, if Stick grows, it's going to be harder for people like Nora to avoid these conversations, or even worse, worrying that they are happening behind their backs. At the moment, Stick users have put close to $5 million at stake to back up their goals. A nice start for a 2.5-year-old startup that hasn't done any advertising. Most people, however, still haven't heard of us. But imagine a world where most people have heard of Stick. Indeed, as a thought experiment, imagine a world where most people who are serious about weight loss or quitting smoking use $500 commitment contracts to reach their goals. Imagine that Stick is as well known and as well used as Facebook or Google. Oh, were it only so. Indeed, as long as I'm dreaming, imagine that Dean's smoking study is replicated and shows again and again that commitment contracts are effective tools for both weight loss and smoking cessation. In that world, what should we think about someone who says that he's serious about losing weight, but simultaneously isn't willing to use a tool that is widely used and proven to work? At least one reasonable reaction is skepticism. Maybe the person who's unwilling to commit isn't really serious about change. In a world where credible commitments are possible, other protestations that, "this time I'm really going to lose weight," are so much cheap talk. All in all, I'd say it's likely that if a person chooses to forego an effective weight loss treatment, some important part of that person's psyche prefers the pleasures of eating to the pleasures of a slimmer physique. It's the same kind of reaction I'd give today to someone who said he was serious about staying in touch with his high school classmates, but refuses to use Facebook. Or imagine an even more extreme hypothetical, in which friends or loved ones offer to pay you to put money at risk. Instead of begging Andy Mayer to commit to a maintenance weight, imagine what would happen if I offered to compensate him to commit. I might have offered to pay him $100 cash today if he would put $500 at risk for the next 6 months to keep his weight below 185 pounds. Could Andy turn down the $100 and still with a straight face claim that he really intends to maintain his weight? One of the most powerful things about the mere existence of Stick is that it can change the conversation. Beware the person who swears that she's going to lose weight, but isn't willing to put her money where her mouth is. Consider the repentant husband who swears up and down that he will stop his philandering. If he refuses to sign a post-nup forking over more of the community property if he strays again, you should worry that he isn't really serious about changing his low-down, cheating ways. The mere option of creating a commitment contract, which some people take and others forego, becomes a kind of sincerity filter. This kind of filtering already happens with home mortgages. Banks are leery of lending to borrowers who swear up and down that they really intend to pay back the loan, but aren't willing to put up any security. While my suggestion to Nora of, quote, forfeiture if you smoke, unquote, probably struck her as weird, the ubiquity of mortgage security makes the forfeiture consequence for failing to live up to your mortgage promise seem only natural. But to change the conversation, this commitment option must itself be heard. The possibility of committing to weight loss has to become sufficiently salient so that individuals realize they have to make a choice. At present, it's all too easy for dieters to ignore the stick option. And fair warning, your friends like Nora may be upset if you tell them about the stick option. We don't like to be judged for the roads we haven't taken. As stick grows, it's going to be harder to avoid these judgments. Why did your boss make a toothless New Year's resolution to lose weight when he could have easily signed up for a stick resolution that was much more likely to achieve the desired results? In such a world, traditional resolutions are not worth the paper they are often not even printed on. Fessing up. Today, there is only one diet treatment that has strong statistical evidence of producing substantial, sustained weight loss, and it's not the $500 diet. No, the one and only medically proven treatment for sustained weight loss is bariatric surgery. Nowadays, more than 200,000 patients a year go under the knife with gastric bypasses and laparoscopic banding procedures. The health benefits of the surgery for the morbidly obese, people with BMIs over 40, has been marked. A 2008 meta-analysis of more than 20,000 patients showed that after more than 2 years, patients on average had lost more than 30% of their body weight and more than 60% of their excess weight. What's more, the surgery helped to dramatically reduce the incidence of hypertension, sleep apnea, and type 2 diabetes. No other diet program, including the $500 diet, has large-scale evidence of being able to produce even a 10% average weight loss after 2 years. Sure, the $500 diet has worked for me, now closing in on 4 years. But like Subway's Jared, I'm an anecdote. I'm not solid scientific data. We also know that the self-reported success rate of thousands of stick dieters who put money at risk is over 70%. But most of these are short-term contracts. And who's to say what proportion lied in their self-reports? The current lack of data isn't a particular embarrassment for the $500 diet. At this writing, stick has only been up and running for about 3 years. We're working with medical researchers at Stanford to start running randomized tests using the platform, and we have hopes of moving the testing toward a full-blown randomized control study, rigorously testing the site's effectiveness as a weight loss tool. The dismal consensus among obesity experts is that, absent surgery, it's simply impossible to achieve long-term, even a 50% success rate of 10% weight loss. Weight Watchers, for example, doesn't even average weight loss of 5% after 2 years. At the moment, surgery is the only game in town if you want to undertake a treatment proven to sustain substantial weight loss. Surgery is so successful at helping the morbidly obese that there is a raging debate in the healthcare community on whether government, employers, and or insurance carriers should start expanding coverage so that people with BMIs of 35 or even 30 would have the bariatric option. But surgery is also expensive, and the operation itself may kill as many as 1% of the patients. Instead of expanding coverage and having 1 or 2 million bariatric operations a year, it's natural to ask whether there are other treatments close to bariatric surgery, but cheaper and with lower iatrogenic risk, that might produce something closer to a 50% success rate. Well, it might help to notice that bariatric surgery is a kind of commitment device. Steve Levitt and Stephen Dubner, the authors of Freakonomics, have called the surgery just, quote, a far more drastic commitment device, unquote, than other incapacitating strategies like taping your refrigerator shut. Instead of tying your hands to the mask, these surgeries tie or suture your stomach to a fraction of its original size. In searching for alternative techniques, the $500 diet is a natural place to start because it bears a strong family resemblance to the only strategy that has been proven to work. They are both serious commitment devices that share three core attributes of being portable, prolonged, and potentially painful. To be sure, bariatric surgery is an incapacitating commitment, while the $500 diet is what I call a deterring commitment. The surgery limits your physical capacity to eat a lot, while the $500 diet takes choice off the table by threatening conditions that are too onerous to contemplate. But in a deeper sense, both approaches use the prospect of pain to stop you from eating too much. If you try to eat a lot after surgery, your stomach will hurt. If you try to eat a lot after signing a commitment contract, your wallet will hurt. The $500 diet, like bariatric surgery, is also portable. It goes wherever you go. Locking your freezer might keep you from eating ice cream at home, but it doesn't stop you from dropping by your local Dairy Queen. In a world where easy access to temptation seems to be lurking around every corner, it's crucial to have a commitment that stops you from overindulging when you're at work or at a friend's house. You can run, but you can't hide from the effects of either surgery or the $500 diet. You can't go AWOL without feeling their untoward effects. The $500 diet is also like surgery in that it can be long-lasting. Both can be protracted commitments. You can create a stick contract that lasts for up to a year, and you can then sign up again for another year and another. Indeed, James Herman's and Lisa Sanders' smoking contracts are lifetime contracts. The weight loss pill, Ally, the brand name for the drug Orlistat, which partially blocks your body's ability to absorb fat, also bears a family resemblance to surgery. It's a commitment device that is also portable and potentially painful. Ally users who eat too much fat are immediately visited with the unpleasant digestive side effects of, quote, oily spotting, flatus with discharge, and fecal urgency, unquote. This potential discomfort and embarrassment is sufficient to change your incentives to eat, but Ally falls flat when it comes to sustainability. It only works as long as you keep taking the pills. There's nothing to stop someone who started the Ally program from stopping. There's nothing that makes it a sustained or protracted commitment. Indeed, someone who starts a year-long stick contract is protected from changing his or her mind for the next 12 months. It's this irreversibility of the stick contract that makes it especially like the surgery alternative. In this respect, the Ally treatment is unfortunately more like Antabuse. Antabuse is the trade name for the drug that helps people commit for about a week not to drink alcohol. Antabuse does not literally disable you from drinking, but like Ally, Antabuse makes indulgence immediately unpleasant. Within 5 minutes of ingesting alcohol, an Antabuse user will experience severe nausea and vomiting along with all the other symptoms of a horrible hangover. The problem is reversibility of the commitment. People who want to start drinking simply stop taking the Antabuse. The reversibility problem of Ally and Antabuse doesn't mean these drugs can't be part of valuable treatments, but it does suggest that they are likely to be more effective if they are used in combination with a commitment contract. You can enter into a commitment contract to use Ally for a year or to keep attending your weekly Weight Watchers meetings. By now, you should realize that when it comes to weight loss, committing to a sustained plan is crucial if you want to have a reasonable chance of success. The protracted irreversibility of a stick contract, the ability to commit to a long-term maintenance, is one of its strongest attributes to affect change. Given the wealth of evidence suggesting that people work especially hard to avoid losing money, the $500 diet is the only non-surgical treatment out there that has a reasonable shot of producing the holy grail of weight loss, a 50% chance of a sustained substantial loss. A different kind of diet plan. Most diet books tell you what kind of things to put in your mouth. Weight Watchers teaches you how to count points. Jenny Craig sells you prepackaged meals. I say almost nothing about what should go in your mouth and instead focus exclusively on setting the right goals and putting the right layers of accountability in place to change your tastes, your preferences, and your priorities. Most diet books conveniently refuse to mention that they don't have solid empirical evidence that their plans even work after 2 years. Readers caught up in the anecdotes of short-term success overlook the depressing truth that most dieters after 2 years weigh about the same as they did before dieting. The Sisyphean quality of weight loss has led me toward heterodox advice that attempts to break the seemingly endless cycle of failed dieting. The $500 diet has a repeated theme of telling you things that most dieters don't want to hear. In a world of free everything, I say, put a lot of money at risk. In a world where most dieters want to lose 15% or more, I say, only 10% is feasible. In a world where people want to lose quick, I say only lose a pound a week and forfeit money if you lose more than 5 pounds in any week. In a world where people are focused on the next week, I say focus on the next year. If at first you do succeed, commit to stick with it. I want you to take the subtitle of this book seriously. The plan is really just for people who are committed to real change. If you aren't willing to commit now to a credible maintenance plan backed by substantial consequences for backsliding, you're probably better off dabbling with the temporary weight loss that is the preordained result for most dieters. But if you are ready to change your life, this 7-step plan gives you a mechanism to strengthen your resolve, to screw your courage to the sticking place. The $500 diet offers a way to break the cycle of fluctuating failure. Together, we can change our incentives to live healthier lives. Come join the revolution.
Ian Ayers is an economist and lawyer who is the William K. Townsend Professor of Law at Yale Law School and a professor at Yale's School of Management. He is a columnist for Forbes magazine and a regular contributor to the New York Times Freakonomics blog. He served for 7 years as the editor of the Journal of Law, Economics, and Organization, and in 2006 was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He has previously written 11 books, including the companion book Carrots and Sticks, Unlock the Power of Incentives to Get Things Done. His 2007 book Super Crunchers was a New York Times business bestseller and named one of the best economics and business books of the year by The Economist. He lives in New Haven, Connecticut.